Welcome back to the Mom Mentality Show. My name is Austin Chadwick and co-host is Chris Lucian. And today we are very, very excited to have G-Paw Hill with us to talk about some intriguing topics, which is, much smaller steps in, as far as coding and software development, and that the code works for you, you don't work for the code. But before we jump into those, G-Paw, can you give a little introduction about yourself?
Hi, folks. My name is G-Paw Hill. I know that's a kind of a strange name. G-Paw is the letter G, really. Paw, grandpa. And I got that name. I know I look like a bitter old man at this point, so naturally you think of me as a grandpa. But in truth, I got that name 30 years ago, 31 years ago, when I myself was just 30 years old. My wife's a little older than me, and she had kids who were nearly grown at that point, and that's when I got my first grandchild. So, as you can imagine, my friends and family thought that a 30-year-old grandfather was the funniest thing they had ever heard of, and they started calling me at every opportunity grandfather and grandpa, and then eventually settled on G-Paw. And now when I have actually lots and lots of grandkids, of course, it seems perfectly normal. But back then, it was a very strange thing. So when I hung out my shingle out on the internet, G-Paw Hill seemed like the right thing to do. G-Paw is the best job I've ever had. I highly recommend it to everyone. Honestly, it's a great job. Second best job I've ever had has been my career in geekery. I've been a programmer for 40 years. I started in 1980, and I still program every day. I still program pretty much all the time. But of course, I've had some changes over the years. For the last 20 years, I have been coaching software development teams more than I actually code for money. And that's what I do. I travel around North America and Europe and China and here and there. And I hang out with teams of developers, and I help them become more like what they want themselves to be. And so that's my backstory. I am G-Paw Hill pretty much everywhere. It's the name of the website, gpawhill.org. It is my Twitter handle. I write almost exclusively originally for Twitter. You'll see if you go there, it's a crazy account. It's not always safe for work. And I have a lot of interests, and I talk about all those interests. But of course, obviously, a very great deal of it is about that second job, being a professional geek, and how to make that a great job for everybody.
So, fantastic.
That's pretty much
it. Yeah, that's fantastic. And those are two great jobs. And I have to say, your Twitter account, I have learned a lot from it. So I've had a great joy following it and seeing your content there. Including some of your content is a thing about many more, much smaller steps. So what are you thinking here, G-Paw?
So I write a major talk every 6 to 9 months or so. And this year's talk is about exactly this topic. If you want more value faster, take many more, much smaller steps. And I characterize this as what I call rice and garlic advice. A friend of mine, a professional chef for 35 years, at the beginning of the pandemic, about 3 months into quarantine, she's binged every conceivable thing on Netflix. She's read her lifetime supply of books that she wants to read because she's a professional chef. She has nothing to do stuck at home inside her apartment. So she decided that she was going to write her opus magnum, the book that contained the entirety of her complete advice for beginner chefs. Then she wrote one tweet. It had two points in it. That's too much rice. And two, that's not enough garlic. And of course, you know, reading this, I just cracked up, right? That's pretty hilarious, because what's amazing about it is, as blind advice goes for beginning chefs, that's killer advice. Everybody starts by making too much rice, which expands considerably when you cook it. Everybody starts by using one teeny tiny little clove of garlic, even though the flavor almost disappears instantly once you cook it. And it's terrific advice. And I thought to myself, well, I've been doing this for a long time as a software guy and as a coach. Do I have blind advice? Do I have advice that I would just blurt out pretty much anywhere in any context? And the answer is yes, I do. And that advice is to take many more, much smaller steps than what you're taking now. And the thing is, it has exactly that same sort of broad applicability. We could be talking about changing code. We could talk about changing ourselves. We could be talking about changing the world. In every one of those cases, take many more, much smaller steps and you'll go a lot faster. And that's, you know, that's the heart of the topic. But of course, there's all of this. The trade is enormously resistant to this idea because they have worked out a perfectly logical, exquisite theory based on a pile of shaky, untrue, ludicrous premises that they have been using for a long, long time. And so there's more than me just giving the advice. There's all the, okay, this is why your model could not possibly work. This is why, in fact, the most efficient thing to do if you're developing software is to rush and throw all of your resources at a walking skeleton. And then from that point forward, just take, I call them stride limited, activated steps. Activated, I'll do that first. If we're talking about code, when I say activated, I mean shipped. I mean fielded. I mean deployed. If you're one of those situations where you don't ever get to deploy except, you know, every year or so because you're doing firmware or something like that, I still mean emotionally prepped to hit the ship button right now, today. Got a little button down in the corner of your screen. If you're willing to push that to ship it, then you're good. You're good to go. I'll call that activated. So what I'm urging people do is go from states of being activated, taking a step where they're unactivated, and then being activated again. And then when I say stride limited, what I'm saying is make those steps extremely small. And I say extremely small because I know this will freak out my audience, right? If I'm talking about code, I'm talking about 15 or 20 minutes. That's how small I want those steps to be, all the way from activated to activated in 15 minutes. Sometimes life is hard. I might go as much as 45 minutes before I say, nope, I'm in the wrong direction. I got to kill this and do, you know, get reset --hard. But really, I'm talking ridiculously small. If we're talking stories, I'm talking less than a day and a half of team time per story. Shipment to shipment, activated to activated. If you're talking about process changes, I'm talking about well under a week. From it, we're doing it this way to we're doing it this way now. So that gives you an idea of just what I mean when I say small steps. This makes people crazy because it makes the path look something very different from, oh my God, the shortest distance between two points is a straight line. I'm so exhausted by this. You can see what a bitter old man I am. I'm so exhausted by this reasoning, which is so ludicrous, based around the fact that, you know, we will pretend this PowerPoint slide is the plane of software development, and we will draw this line, and each step will only be as big or as long or as huge as we decide, and it will be efficient because the shortest distance between two points is a straight line.
Yeah.
Which is true in exactly one domain. plane geometry.
Yeah.
In fact, Euclidean plane geometry, that's the only place that's true. It's not true in any of us' lives, in our daily lives, in any sense. And it certainly is not true in software development.
You mentioned...
Didn't that just come?
Yeah. No, that was really good. That was I love it. I wanted to applaud at the end. So you mentioned three different time scales there. You said kind of individual pieces of code before they're activated. The time scale of a story, and then I think it was maybe like a day or day and a half or something like that, and so on. And so in those time scales, you're saying production deployed in a 15-minute span, or is that like a refactoring because it's not a story, or is it like an individual component of something, maybe feature flagged? How do you, can you explain the 15 minutes more?
Yeah, the big thing that keeps people from being able to do this is they're actually holding on to a criterion for step that I'm not actually holding on to. And their criterion is that it must make, it must provide positive value for the user or for, you know, the fake stakeholder who pretends to be the user in your organization.
Or just better naming so the next developer doesn't get as confused, right?
Yeah, right. Whereas, in fact, my rule is no non-negative experience. That is, I don't want to make the value lower. I don't care whether you make it higher on any given step or not. When I draw it as a little red blob. That's us pulling ourselves together with enough value to complete the step. And then an arrow, and then a blue blob, which is the intrinsic benefit of limiting the stride. The intrinsic, the part that happens just because it's a step that actually gives us value. Mm-hmm. And then on some of those, there will also be a green ball. And the green one is, of course, actual positive improvement for the person who experiences or drives mostly the purpose and origins of your product.
Yeah, and a lot of that, I think, has to do with, like,
you know, they want it to be greater than, and I'm saying, you know, greater than or equal than is good enough.
Yeah. You know, avoiding the sunk cost fallacy in general, right? It becomes a lot easier in that scenario, because when you have that really long PowerPoint line, then, you know, it's painful to everyone to abandon something where a small stride is easier to abandon. And so people start making more rational decisions.
People will often cite the XKCD cartoon, and you know, Randall Monroe is one of my big heroes, and I will very often start my day just by going and looking at a couple of XKCDs just to get me in the right space. But he has one where he talks about, you think it's 15 minutes or, you know, a 15 minute interruption, but it's actually ruining my 18 hours a day. I feel you, but the reason that that happens is because you decided to have an 18-hour day. Mm-hmm. If you decided to have a day broken into 10-minute segments, then fine. Finish your 10-minute segments, and then finish one of them, and then fine. I can talk about anything. I can help you with anything. I can take care of my dogs or my kid. I can call it a day. I can handle a meeting. I can do any of those things. They're choosing to require of themselves 6 or 8 hours of concentration in order to solve their problem. And the problem doesn't need that. They've just chosen to draw a step line that is that long. They'd be better off drawing many, many shorter step lines, even if none of those steps until the very last one actually enable the green bubble.
Nice. So, I mean, I definitely heard some... motivation for the I'm going to pull it up again just so I say it right, because I think the words are chosen carefully. Many more, much smaller steps. And if you could say it, you know, what would be your like top two reasons for recommending this? You know what I mean? Like in your experience or, you know, data or whatever.
The intrinsic benefit of the step is enormous. and it is ignored in almost all analyses. And that would be the first reason. And the second reason, 23, I think, years ago, I went to the very first XP immersion, extreme programming. I started the week as a student and ended it as a teacher because, in fact, I had been slipping XP under the door at my client for some time before that first class. But anyway, I went in, and one of Kent Beck's most important, significant questions to ask when anybody's advocating for anything or telling us what they're doing right now, which is what would happen whenever we approach this topic, and this is my second reason, is just to say, you know, well, how's that working out for you? Because when you actually go and look at these organizations that are not using many more much smaller steps, what you're going to find is, you know, it isn't going very well right now. So, you know, there's an implicit sort of compared to what? And that's the second reason, is because I want people to instead of comparing, yourself to the PowerPoint that shows the beautiful laid out plan or the JIRA or the managerial dots on an incomprehensible report, instead of thinking to compare many more much smaller steps to that, they should be comparing it to how it's working out for them right now. And my sense is that it's not working out for them very well, and they know it.
Nice. No, I like that a lot. And I think, it points the reflection back to how's it working for me and my team right now, right? As opposed to some other measurement. And I really like that. And given that target, how do you coach or help teams learn to take many more, much smaller steps?
Well, it's trade secret, of course. I can't tell you that.
All right, we'll cut this part of the video. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah. Okay, now what? In order to understand my answer, you know, we got to expand the hell out of that question. How do we get anybody to do anything ever?
Sure.
My answer will usually shock beginners, but they always ask me, well, how do you get them to do what you want them to do? And the answer is, I don't. I get them to do what they want to do. Right. I go into rooms and I see people who are not having a good time, and I talk to them about establishing what is the owie here? What don't you like about what you're doing? And then I say, okay, well, what if I could get rid of that for you? And I try to work with easiest, nearest owie first is one of my, you know, branded slogan things. I try to find the smallest thing that we all agree is a problem and attack that small thing and get rid of it so it's not a problem anymore. And I just keep doing that. And of course, over time, you know, all coaching is relationship. So, you know, it's all very hard to, you know, you got to, if you're an external coach like I am, you know, you walk in the door with a trust deficit that is substantial, right? That's hard because, you know, the teams I work with, they don't trust some guy, no matter how, isn't this a beautiful shirt? No matter how weird the shirt is, they don't trust me. So that's why I start with the very smallest things. That's why I take my time. That's why, you know, out on the market, I'm always telling people, you know, the key attribute for anyone who wants to change the world is patience. If you don't have patience, you're not going to be able to pull it off. So I inch my way, because the thing is, take many more, much smaller steps applies to coaching as much as it does to programming, because it's actually a truism about change. It's not a truism about, you know, bits and bytes. So anyway, the long and the short of it is, I tell my client deciders, the ones who actually decide, bring this guy in, let's see if he can do anything. I tell them, so here's what it's going to look like for the first 2-3 weeks. It's going to look like you're paying me an awful lot of money to just hang out. And so that's not what it is. But that's what it's going to look like to you because you don't do what I do. So you're not going to be able to tell whether I'm doing it or not. What I'm actually doing during those weeks is gathering up my sense of what those alleys are, building my relationship with the individuals involved in those teams, deciding, helping them decide which problems are the easiest ones to solve, and stuff like that, you know, building towards it. And then, you know, at some point you get to a place where they'll actually trust you enough to take a suggestion and they'll try it. But I'm very careful to make my suggestions always experiments. I'm not a big arguer. I'm a huge arguer, but I don't win as a coach by having the best argument. I win as a coach by being trusted and by arguing about experiments. Let's try an experiment. That part I'll argue for. Let's give it a shot. What's the worst that could happen? Company's not going to go out of business if we try this for a week. So let's try it for a week and see what happens. And then if we don't like it, we don't have to do it. Which means, you know, you have to invest pretty heavily in making sure they like it.
Nice. Yeah. And I've seen a couple of things come to mind that have a huge, in my experience at least, huge synergy with the many more, much smaller steps idea. And that is, mobbing for me, I've seen a huge change once I started mobbing in smaller steps. And I think with the code and with the process or change, you know, or whatever, how we're working, you know, the kind of human or side of things. And that I noticed when I started mobbing, there are things like micro retrospectives instead of, you know, week long blocks of change experiments. It's like, hey, how did the last hour go? Oh, do we want to change something? Okay, let's try that. You know, and when you're side by side with someone for, you know, an hour or several hours to say like, hey, do you want to try this? It's usually much more like, oh, okay. You know,
why not, right?
Yeah. And then also I've noticed something happens in a mob where there's someone who has bought in to try the experiment of smaller change and they help the mob stay honest, right? They're like, whoa, I know you have a great idea about what you're about to do, but can we commit what you just did right there real quick? Cause we, you know, we did a nice little refactoring and let's document that, you know? And so, just wanted to share that. If there were any other little things that tips and tricks that have helped teams do smaller things, please share.
I absolutely agree with you in general about just about the benefits of working in a group like that. I don't know, you guys are calling it mobbing, but I've been yelled at and told I'm supposed to call it ensemble programming now.
Yeah,
but I don't care, either way is fine with me. I know what
that's okay mean. That's okay, we can call it ensemble too, that's fine. Yeah.
So but yes, exactly, the transformations that happen in a team just from starting to work like that for, you know, a couple hours a week. Let's just put it on the clock. Let's walk in here and from 10 to noon, we're just going to pick some random thing that needs to be done to this code and we're going to work together on it. And then of course you get that whole thing. I'm sure you folks have been through this and have had your teams go through it where you're like, I could not possibly switch off in my mob on a 5-minute boundary. And, you know, listen, this is what happened to me with test-driven development. I kept saying to myself for the first 2 years I was learning TDD, I'd say I could not possibly do a smaller change than that. Mm-hmm. Yes, you can. You're just not looking for it. Once you start looking for them, they're everywhere. And the same happens in terms of them. Yeah, of course you can get enough done to walk cheerfully away from the keyboard after 5 minutes. You can. You just got to look for that and you got to think at that level. And I think that again, you know, I'm going meta, the whole thing of learning, be it TDD or the more smaller steps or any of that, that happens inside the mob also happens inside the team that inches towards mobbing. Mm-hmm. It gets a little more mobbing, gets a little more mobbing, gets a little more fun. Because mobbing is actually pretty pleasant.
Yeah.
It is for me. and gets more practice at mobbing, which I think is important. One of the things, so, you know, I didn't come up with mobbing. I came up with pairing, right? When I was a kid, you know, back then we didn't know nothing about mobs. We were working pairs. And one of the reasons that pairing has struggled and that even today mobbing still struggles to gain the sort of traction that it needs is that it's really easy to say that this is supposed to be some sort of natural skill. Everyone is a born mob programmer, a born pair. Yeah, no, not so much. It takes practice. You got to get good at it. You got to work on your game, you know? And so when I inch into mobbing, I give people practice at doing that. Mm-hmm. And of course the great beauty of the mob is, you know, maybe I got 8 people in the room, right? 8 of those people are all learning that practice at the same time, and they're modeling for each other, and they're easing into this thing in a way that creates, you know, tremendous results.
Yeah, that's awesome. You know, based on time, I think it's a good point to transition to the code works for you. You don't work for the code. And so, yeah, what are your thoughts there? I love the succinct thing there. So, yeah, what do you think?
I don't know. A few minutes ago, I mentioned the person who needs the 6 hours in order to feel like they get anything done. They need a 6-hour block of peaceful, solo, quiet concentration in a morgue somewhere. And what I said was, it is that way because you built it to be that way. It's because you've committed to a process that is based on that idea. So jump in a completely different direction. I work with an organization, actually I've worked with several clients who you know, bought into microservice magic. And you know, they have all these microservices, and they have there's a dev environment, and there's a stage environment. And then there's prod, and that's what they got. And they all, and of course there's no possibility that their company will pay another $40,000 a month for another environment in which to work. And here's the thing, it's almost never necessary to actually run on one of those environments. The only reason people have to run on one of those environments is because they arrange their packaging in such a fashion that it can't be run on my dev box. It can't. All they would have to do is take the guts of that application, turn it into a library with a skinny little HTML wrapper around it, and then, or HTTP wrapper around it, and then bundle all those libraries together in one app and run them on their computer. They could do that. They have chosen not to do that. So I always say it's really two things, right? That it's two sides of the same page. The negative version of it is me looking at somebody and saying, you know, it is that way because you built it to be like that. And then the other side of it, hopefully more positive, the code works for you. You don't work for the code. The process works for you. You don't work for the process. If the code isn't what you want it to be, then change the damn code. It's not that hard. I mean, it's really not that hard. If it's slowing me down because I can't get those environments freed up, then why don't I change the code so that it doesn't have to have those environments to run? If it is extremely hard for me to test aspect X of my code, why not rearrange the code so that it becomes easy for me to test that aspect X of my code, right? It's our artifact. Yeah, we're the ones who made it.
People throughout their day even have time to work on these things because they're waiting for the thing to become available, right? So not only do they have the time to do it, but they also have the need, and a lot of time you know, automation often can make a case for itself. And there are different forms of that. And that might just be, you know, wrapping cloud services so that they run locally so that you can have a full deployment of a local machine. Yeah.
Because the truth of the matter is my HTTP transport works. My bugs never happen because Spring Boot doesn't know how to route an endpoint to my code. My code doesn't work 99% of the time because my code doesn't work, right? It doesn't do what I thought it did. And so the relevance of having all that packaging and heavyweightness and unbelievable round trip times to actually find out whether a change you made had an impact, the cost of that is staggering, and it provides me almost no benefit. It's like, you know, I also don't test the string class in my JDK. I don't, you know, I work for a living. I don't have time for that. It works. I know it works because I don't know what they do the McDonald's. How many Java burgers sold every time you install a new JRE? It's like 800 billion instances of the JRE. Well, you know what? Pretty sure that the bug I just found is not in the JRE. I'm pretty sure it's in the stupid logic that I wrote to solve my own stupid problem.
Yeah.
So you can see, I get happy and then I get sad when I start talking about this. Like, come on, it's your toy. Build it your way. Build it so that it's easy to build. You don't have to build it. People all over the world in the geek trades are trying to use the production app to make the production app. Like, well, why don't you just make a making app and use the making app to make the production app? It's all code. You could do it, but they don't see it because of the traditions in the code. I mean, traditions in the trade and the straight line PowerPoint and all of that sort of bad logic. They don't understand. It's easy for you to change the code. And if it isn't easy, then you should change the code so that it becomes easy for you to change the code.
Yeah,
that's that ramp. Boy, you're just triggering rants out of me today. I feel kind of guilty.
We're pretty good at doing that.
yeah. Nice. No, we love it. Yeah, keep them coming. And this is a realization. It reminds me of a realization I've been having recently. So I think sometime after mobbing, I had this realization that I developed an allergic reaction to kind of lean waste and like a feedback sense, you know what I mean? Where, you know, anytime I'm not mobbing, I'm like, oh my gosh, this is taking forever to find out what this other person thinks about this code we just wrote, right? And I think I've had a similar transition with feedback loops on the code. So like after experiencing instantaneous feedback, you know what I mean? Like, you know, you run the test and you find out right away or you push the code and it goes to the pipeline and does it work or not being instantaneous. And then switching to context where that's not happening, oh my gosh, that's an emotional roller coaster. Like once you've experienced the good, it becomes really hard to tolerate slower feedback loops, right? And I think I like your phrase a lot because most transformations I've seen are when people feel empowered, right? Because I've come into teams before where they're just kind of like a lot of apathy, whatever. And then once they feel empowered to run an experiment or to change something and they see good come from it, you can really, you know, start see the snowball effect, you know, start happening. And I like that phrase because it really empowers them to let's do something about this, you know.
A lot of what I teach and a lot of what I try to do as a coach is actually just reawaken the joy. I know there's this whole myth about all these people who entered the trade to make more money. And honestly, it's just not true because programming just sucks if you don't like it. And it doesn't matter how much they pay you. And I've known people who came into the trade because of the big bucks and then they leave it after 3 months and, you know, they won't even own a phone anymore because there's too much computer in it. And I mean, seriously, because programming is actually like I said, I mean, it just sucks if you never got any joy out of making a computer do something. But a lot of people, what happens is they actually started with that joy. And then it just went, you know, slowly ratcheting down. So now they hate their jobs, they hate their lives, they hate their work, and they just want to get the hell out of there and go home and be with their families. And a lot of what I try to do and a lot of what I try to get across to the people I work with and the people I talk to out on the internet is you got to go back to that joy, man. Because it's a crummy life if you're not having fun. It's crummy. And if we can reawaken, if I can reawaken that geek joy in anybody, then I consider myself a complete winner. I'm like, oh, I got another one. I brought another one back to the fold. Yeah, I think we don't spend enough time talking about each other.
Yeah, absolutely.
Taking care of each other.
And I totally agree. Like, you know, I've worked with people that it was just like, they hated programming. They told everybody they hated programming. And they were decent at it. And they, you know, they did, you know, things that were like that. But and even for them, it's just like, well, why do you do this? It's like, well, it's big money and things like that. It's like, there's other things you can do, right? And then on the flip side, you know, even in our environment, we get people coming from other development environments and then just saying, oh my God, I'm having so much fun working with everybody. And, it wasn't at all like this at my previous place. And it's just so different. And things can become better. And a lot of times it's just the systems or that assumption that things have to be a certain way. So I really appreciate what you're saying there. Before we wrap up, because we're coming up on time here, do you have anything you want to share or plug before we close out the show?
No plug. You already got my data. The share part is just to say that for me, I just really want to stress this conversation is about changing code, but it's also about change. It's not the code part isn't the important part of this. The change part is. And I hope that people understand how serious and committed I am to understanding and seeking change in the trade. Change in your teams, yes, change in your code, change in ourselves, change out in the world. And that mantra I led off with, if you want more value faster, if you want more change faster, take many more, much smaller steps. And please, all of our listeners, I hope, understand, look outside the monitor. There's stuff going on out there in the world. There's changes you're going to want to be a part of. And try to take these ideas and take them out there and give them a shot. That's it for me.
Well said, Jipa. Thank you very much. And to all of our viewers and listeners, you know, if you know somebody that either is in the software business and hates it, or if they've lost the joy and maybe could find it, sharing this video with or podcast with somebody in that situation could help them in more ways than one. So please be sure to share, like, subscribe, hit the notification bell, all that stuff, and we'll see you next time. Thank you very much, and bye.